I'm Dennis Owsley, and this is the second hour of Jazz Unlimited's Jazz History of St. Louis documentary. Before playing the jazz music of St. Louis, we need to understand that in the 1920s, it was highly informed by the blues. In the Middle Street area, known as Deep Morgan, blues musicians practiced their craft in the cabarets. Blues pianists such as Speckled Red, Roosevelt Sykes, and Wesley Wallace found work. Wallace recorded a wonderful train blues for Paramount in 1930, number 29, which described a trip from Cairo, Illinois to St. Louis.
This train is called 29. Out of Cairo coming to East St. Louis. Oh, she got in Marysburg. She showed that whistle. She blowed her whistle this way. I was intending to get off in Troy, Illinois. I mean, that day was running. She wasn't doing nothing but running hard or something like this. She got 40. She thought she'd blow that whistle again. She blow that whistle something like this. She's loping now. Get off that train, but she's going too fast. I hallway and touch one foot on the ground. My heel like knock my brains out. I hallway and touch both by right tight and fell off. This is noise I made when I hit that ground. I'm rolling now. I got up and waved my hand and told her goodbye. This way she's keep walking on in the East St. Louis.
That was number 29, Wade and voiced by Wesley Wallace in 1929. Early Delta blues guitarists also performed in St. Louis during the period. These guitarists include Lonnie Johnson, who went on to great fame and lived in St. Louis from 1920 to 1926. The singer Victoria Spivey recorded in St. Louis in 1926 and worked as a staff writer for the St. Louis Publishing Company from 1926 to 29. In addition, a thriving blues scene on the east side of the Mississippi had such well-known clubs and other establishments as the Blue Flame Club, the 905 Club, Jim's Place, and Catty Red's. Boots on the Levee was a going concern because the riverboats could dock near the establishment. And apparently, whites were also in all of these places. Here are three lesser-known blues records made in St. Louis. North Wind Blues by Luella Miller, East St. Louis Stomp by the Searcy Trio, and Freakish Rider Blues by Burt Snake Root Hatton. And this is the Jazz History of St. Louis, Part 1 on Jazz Unlimited.
Thank you.
Dennis Owsley, and you're listening to Jazz Unlimited in part one of the jazz history of St. Louis. That was a set of three: North Wind Blues by Luella Miller, East St. Louis Stomp by the Searcy Trio, and Freakish Rider Blues by Burt Snake Root Hatton. St. Louis trumpeter Dewey Jackson was heard on the first and third pieces. Lonnie Johnson played both guitar and banjo, and James Stump Johnson played piano on North Wind Blues, and the Searcy Trio was Clifford King Cornet, Edgar Green Clarinet, and DeLouise Searcy on piano. From 1921 to 1928, St. Louis was a center for field recordings of many kinds of music, So we have a record of many bands that worked in St. Louis during the time. The field recordings were done by OK and Brunswick and RCA. They recorded anything that made a sound. And the recordings ranged from preachers and Boy Scout drummers to blues singers and jazz bands. And they didn't care whether they were white or black. They just recorded them. During the 1920s and 30s, a riverboat excursion would take place on any one of several boats. They were almost all owned by the Streckfest brothers. And this was all the rage during the St. Louis late spring, summer, and early fall season. Black bands were featured mainly at night, while white bands mostly worked during the day. Charlie Manese, an important jazz disc jockey and observer of St. Louis jazz, will talk about the importance of St. Louis jazz, while David Hines will share what he found about segregation on the riverboats in the 1920s.
Well, I went into that quite some time ago, and I have used it that material, and I wasn't the originator of the idea or the theory or the conception, but there was a general agreement on it that St. Louis, being the railroad and river transportation center that it was, brought musicians here and carried musicians from here. So the musicians that came here, like Louis from the south, on the riverboats with Fate Marable and so forth, and then the musicians that came through here on the trains and so forth, they learned from our people here. Our people learned from them, and then, as you know, a good many of our people moved from here and became internationally famous jazz people. And about the trumpet name, I think that Jeff Leopold of the Jazz Club, I've questioned him about that, and he told me that he thought it went back to the man in, he was head of the jazz at Jazz Archives at Tulane. His name was Dick Allen. And Dick Allen got in touch with Leopold one time, and he said, we ought to call St. Louis the cradle of the Gabriels, because you've had so many trumpet players from here. And he reeled off a bunch of names and so forth. And Leopold took that, and he has sort of carried the banner. And it is true that we've had a lot of fine trumpet players come from here, starting with the riverboat band leader, Charlie Kreth, who was a trumpet player. And so it goes on down to Clark Terry and Miles, and there were others. And we've had players here now who are recognized around the country. They could go anywhere and hold their own with stage presentations or jazz presentations and so forth. So we're not going to turn the title down, although I imagine some cities might say, well, we've produced just as many trumpet players as you have. And, of course, that would be true for Chicago, New York, and Los Angeles, say. We'll take credit for anything we can get, because we are important. As Frank Driggs and others have said, who are writing about the national scene, they say St. Louis is more important than we recognize, and certainly more important than a lot of outsiders recognize in our contributions into the mainstream of American jazz.
Originally, blacks were excluded from the boat, except for just playing on the boat. And then they decided to, there was such a big interest in the music and everything, to allow blacks to come down one night a week. And, man, that was an event. I mean, that was a very, very special event. People would begin to prepare for that as early as 5 or 4 o'clock, I mean, immediately off from work. And one of the stories I got from a DJ, a former DJ here and former state Senator Mr. Roscoe McQuarrie, who described a scene for me, a typical evening when the blacks would be going down to the boat. You would get dressed in your very, very best clothes, okay? And they said people would walk to the boat. I mean, a long distance, many, many, many blocks to go to the boat. I said, well, how much did it cost to ride a streetcar or a bus? And even though it's because you don't have enough to ride the bus, you don't have enough to go on the boat. But the point was that at that time you didn't have polyester, permanent press. And if you were on a crowded streetcar or anything, your shoes would shine. Somebody might accidentally step on your shoes. Also, if you sat down and it's very hot and humid, you would wrinkle the pants. You didn't want to ruin the crease in the pants. So the coat, you would neatly fold your coat across your arm and you would walk to the boat. And of course, it might be humorous today, but then I think it's something that we wish we had today where we could walk and not worry about a thing. See, at that time, there was nothing to worry about. Beautiful weather and the people just really enjoyed themselves that one night a week.
St. Louis during the 1920s was heavily affected by Prohibition. Of course, as in other cities, Prohibition gave rise to organized crime. All of the speakeasies, ballrooms, and clubs had mob connections, whether they wanted them or not. Elmer Schaeble from East St. Louis was a pianist who worked in theaters and eventually moved to Chicago in 1920. He was one of the first composers in jazz. He made his first recordings with the New Orleans Rhythm Kings in 1922. He's the composer of Bugle Call Rag. A number of white dance bands also worked in St. Louis, most notably the Gene Rodemick Orchestra. Here's a set of two featuring first Elmer Schaeble and his composition Bugle Call Rag with the New Orleans Rhythm Kings in Chicago in 1922, and the Gene Rodemick Orchestra doing By the Pyramids in 1921 with Frank Trumbauer on C Melody Sax doing a series of breaks with alto saxophonist Bernie Kruger. Rodemick spent many seasons in the late teens and early 20s on the riverboats.
Thank you.
Dennis Owsley. We heard Bugle Call Rag by the New Orleans Rhythm Kings in 1922 with Elmer Schabel on piano and composing the tune. And then the Gene Rodemick Orchestra did By the Pyramids in 1921. Frank Trumbauer was born in Carbondale, Illinois, but was raised in St. Louis. His mother was a theater pianist and organist. And by 1920, Trumbauer was working in St. Louis. He recorded San with the Mound City Blue Bloors in 1924, and that C melody saxophone solo was widely admired by everybody, black and white. He was the major influence on tenor saxophonist Lester Young. And you're listening to Jazz Unlimited in part one of the jazz history of St. Louis.
Thank you.
San, we just heard, included Frank Trumbauer on C Melody saxophone, Red McKenzie on comb, Dick Slevin on kazoo, and Jack Bland on banjo. The Blue Blowers were formed in St. Louis by Red McKenzie and were promoted early in their careers by Rudimick. All of the musicians are St. Louisans. As we said earlier, Fate Marable brought a band to St. Louis that included Louis Armstrong and Baby Dodds and Pops Foster and Johnny St. Cyr, most of whom ended up in the Hot Five in Chicago later on, most of whom ended up with King Oliver's Creole Jazz Band. And this band created really a sensation there. But while there's no question that the Marable Band had jazz musicians in it, was the music played on the boats jazz? Most St. Louis Dixieland fans believe it was jazz, but here are the facts, as told by many interviews by the musicians who actually worked on the Streckfest steamers. The band leaders were the Streckfest brothers, not the musicians, and they owned the boats. The Streckfest brothers determined the repertoire, bought the stock arrangements, and insisted that the music was played note for note. The music was the hits of the day. No solos were allowed. Performances and rehearsals were timed to the second, and the musicians were fined for playing too fast or too slow. To me, this doesn't sound like jazz, but an early version of what we would call cover bands. The musicians had to read and play 14 new tunes every 2 weeks, and they became very highly polished players who could read and interpret anything at sight. And some people actually dubbed the riverboats floating conservatories. And these floating conservatories are among the reasons that St. Louis sent so many highly trained jazz musicians out into the world in the 1920s and 1930s. Obviously, the myth of jazz on the riverboats is a myth in St. Louis that won't go away, though. Because on the land and in the cabarets, musicians played jazz. Marable was a hard taskmaster who had a somewhat cruel streak. When a musician was about to be fired, a rehearsal was called. The musician being fired was given a time 15 minutes later than the rest of the band. When he arrived, there was an axe laying in his chair and the band was playing "There'll Be Some Changes Made." Now, here are the only two existing Fate Marable recordings, Frankie and Johnny and Pianoflage in 1924. Thank you. Dennis Owsley, and this is the Jazz History of St. Louis, Part 1 on Jazz Unlimited. And the Marable Band was mostly people from New Orleans, but they had Harvey Langford on trombone, who is the son of P.B. Langford. Besides the riverboats, St. Louis is noted for an identifiable sound in a whole school of black trumpeters that stretches from Charles Kreth in the 1920s to Lester Boy in the 1970s. Here's a collage of short excerpts of St. Louis trumpeters from Kreth to Boy. And in order, they are Charles Kreth, Dewey Jackson, Ed Allen, Louis Metcalf, Oliver Cobb, Shorty Baker, who left in the 30s, Joe Thomas, who left in the 20s, Clark Terry, Miles Davis, and Lester Boy. I'm Dennis Owsley, and you're listening to Jazz Unlimited in part one of the jazz history of St. Louis. And we heard a montage of St. Louis trumpet players that went from 1924 to the 1970s, from Kreff to Bowie. Listening to that, you can hear that each trumpeter has a clear singing tone, and an awful lot of them use mutes. Here are David Hines and Clark Terry telling us about St. Louis trumpet players and how the sound came about.
We just played a few St. Louis trumpet players, about 60 years of St. Louis trumpet history. Is there anything that kind of ties together all of those people from Charlie Kreff up to Lester Bowie, including Miles and Clark Terry and many others?
You know, I talked to a lot of guys and a lot of the band leaders stuff about the St. Louis trumpet players, but after hearing the tape that we had to condense, I could hear them all together, with the lack of recording technology. Certainly the sound, everybody appeared to be very, very tone conscious there. I mean, they pretty much nailed those notes. I mean, they didn't just guess at them. I mean, they were right on nice, big, fat, round sounds there. You know, yeah. I like that. Very melodic kind of playing also. You know.
Very vocal. Is that?
Yeah, yeah.
A lot were, of that. What do you think caused that?
Okay, now this is strictly be my opinion in that, that they were probably imitating vocal styles. If you go back in the 20s, I think Bessie Smith was, one of the first biggies, to really hit on the national scene. Of course, there were other singers, and people tend to relate more to the vocalists more so, and I guess these guys wanted to get their share of the stage also.
That goes all the way back to Charlie Kreff. And I think he was sort of responsible for that in a sense. And another thing that's kind of responsible in a sense was Gustav, the trumpeter, the first trumpeter of the St. Louis Symphony. He used to, all the people that he taught, he would insist on them using Heim mouthpieces. It's a very thin, very deep trumpet mouthpiece. And all the guys around town used to hear this sound that was gotten with this high mouthpiece, and most of them, if they couldn't come by a high mouthpiece, they got something as close to that as they possibly could, and they all shot for that particular sound. And I think that possibly Gustav and Charlie Kreff, way back in those days, were sort of responsible for that sound that most of the trumpeters in the St. Louis area sort of strived to get.
Charles Kreff's grandson is a church musician who lives in St. Louis but travels all over the world. He remembers the important contributions that his grandfather made to St. Louis jazz. Kreff was one of the first black band bookers in St. Louis. Kreff had several bands working on any given evening and would make appearances at all of the functions to play a tune or two. Kreff was also a gambler and would often lose the musicians' pay. I'm Dennis Owsley, and this is the Jazz History of St. Louis, Part 1 on Jazz Unlimited.
Well, he emerged on the jazz scene in St. Louis in the early 20s, 20, 21, around that time. Before that, he was a traveling musician with the circus.
Really?
Yeah, he played the trumpet in Ringling Brothers, Barnum and Bailey, I believe. And a lot of other traveling shows. He was from Ironton, Missouri. And for some reason, he settled in St. Louis around 1920.
Mm-hmm.
At the age of 30. He was born in 1890. But no, he played the trumpet mainly, and the accordion in his later years, and also the saxophone. All the musicians came through St. Louis. They would leave St. Louis and have to come back. For some reason, there was a lot of work in St. Louis. And Charles Kreff was... in essence, a major contractor in this town. He had 6 working bands at one time, all under his name. I understand that even the big names like Louis Armstrong, when he was broke, would come to St. Louis to stay with Charlie Kreff. That's right. I've read many accounts. I have here an account of Pops Foster, New Orleans jazzman, and he was one of the most prominent bass players of that day. All around, and he speaks of when he needed work, it was Charlie Kreff. You didn't want Charlie Kreff to cut you off, because if he got mad at you for a gambling debt or because you wouldn't lend him money, you know, he wouldn't hire you. And that would go on for, you know, months or so, and then he would reconcile with his friends again. He was a character, a real character. But if you needed the money, you see Charlie Kreft. There was one story where he was supposed to be working with somebody, and I don't know the name in particular, and I don't think it's documented as to who it was, but he had heard from another friend of his of the reputation of that person for not paying, or not paying on time. So what Charles Kreft did when he worked that evening was stand all night at the box office and got his money as it came in. you know, strange things. He was a big gambler. I mean, obviously he didn't leave a whole bunch of money. I didn't inherit any. He made it all, but he gambled it all away. The guys didn't want to really get rich. They just wanted to live the life.
Uh-huh. Which he did, I guess. I would imagine he had a pretty comfortable living doing all the stuff that he was doing.
Yeah, I understand that. Now, they say he drove a big Marmon car from job to job. I don't know what a Marmon is. Maybe they make them in Salt Lake City. I don't know. But it's, but it's M-A-R-M-O-N. And he would drive from job to job and make one appearance at this job. Then he'd make an appearance at the next job, all under the name of Charles Kreft and the Jazzomaniacs. He was one of the, you know, the pillars of the company. I mean, Charles Kreft was the OK label. In fact, the first blues recording ever made of a male vocalist was on the OK label with Charles Kreft. Floyd Campbell was his male vocalist for years. Yeah, he did the My Daddy Rocks Me with One Steady Roll. He just lived the life. He played the trumpet probably because it afforded him the lifestyle that he wanted to live, which was not only money. Money only was the means, you know, by which he could do all the other things he wanted to do. Because he was more than a musician. He was also, you know, riverboat gambler.
I'm Dennis Owsley, and this is the Jazz History of St. Louis, Part 1 on Jazz Unlimited. Here are two recordings of the Charles Kreft Band in 1924 and 1927. Market Street Blues and Butterfinger Blues. Butterfinger Blues will follow the station break.
Now the gal I love, she don't pay me no mind. And it keeps me farther